Mute. Oh, is that better?
All right.
Well, good morning, everyone. Yeah, I'm so glad I didn't have one of the 9 o'clock slots this morning. Okay, so let me spend just a moment explaining who I am and how I come to be talking about software-defined radio stuff here. I tell people that I made my first personal contribution of source code to what we now think of as this free and open source software community thing back in about 1979. And in about 1983 or 4, I finally, while I was at university, had the opportunity to fulfill one of those long-time goals of becoming an amateur radio operator. And my history since then has sort of been interwoven in the sense that I've had a chance to do cool software things with radio and cool radio things with software. And along the way, I got very involved with the Debian project, served as Debian project leader for a while. I'm still chairman of the Debian Distribution's Technical Committee and president of Software in the Public Interest, which is the parent nonprofit organization that gives Debian some legal existence and financial contribution management capabilities. I also have a day job, which I have to remind people of every once in a while. I serve as chief technologist for HP's open source and Linux business. And in that context, I spend a lot of time paying attention to what's going on that's interesting from a broad technology perspective and try to identify places where there are opportunities for the company to go engage in doing interesting new stuff. And it's actually been kind of fun because one of the really hot topic areas that has cut across a number of the company's businesses in the last few years has been the impact of what happens when commodity computing platforms, you know, things like Intel and AMD processors, get fast enough that they can do things that previously only specialized signal processing kinds of chips could do. And the impact that this is having on everything from the way media streaming technology works to how we go about designing and building wireless network interfaces. There are a lot of intersections between this technology stuff and what I do in my day job. However, I want to be completely clear and completely upfront that there's a reason I'm not running with, you know, HP branded slides today. And that is, this is a hobby for me. This is something that I do for fun. And what I want to do is share with you today some of what I think is really intriguing about this whole software-defined radio thing and show you how you can actually take advantage of some, you know, widely available open source components to go off and build interesting new communications devices, play around, you know, record all of the FM stations in your local area simultaneously if that's what you want to do, stuff like that. You know, hopefully at the end of this, you'll understand a little bit about what this is all about, why it might be interesting, and how you can play too. So to do that, I'm going to start out by talking just a little bit about what this whole concept of software-defined radio is, sort of what I call a gentle introduction to the concept. Then I'm going to talk specifically just a little bit about this project called GNU Radio, which has been around for a while, and it's in effect, it's an erector set for building, or, you know, a bunch of Lego blocks for building. I keep having to think about the generation I'm talking to. Did you guys ever get the chance to play with real metal erector sets that, you know, you could pinch yourself with? You know, if you don't have a chance to bleed on your toys, do you ever have a chance to really learn? So anyway, I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about GNU Radio. And it's impossible to talk about the GNU Radio project or any of this stuff in a larger context without understanding some of the politics of open source software-defined radio, and in particular, the intersection between what people who want to work on software-defined radios are trying to accomplish and what the legislative and you know, media industry folks and so forth swirling around us would like to constrain us to being able to do. There's been both good news and bad news in the last couple of years on this front, and I'll try and give you just sort of a quick sense of where I think things are there. And then what I really want to do today, though, is share with you some interesting hardware and things that people are really doing with this hardware. I've brought some toys along for show and tell, you know, interesting little data acquisition widgets to hang on USB buses, interesting slightly larger, really cool software-defined radio peripherals. And I'll show you some other projects that have just recently started that I think are going to provide some really interesting building blocks for prototyping and developing interesting new communications and communications-like products going forward. I would love for this to be a reasonably interactive session, but in the interest of the amount of time we have, what I'm going to try and do is sort of whiz through the sort of background and presentation stuff for a while, and then we'll shift gears a little bit. I have a couple of good friends in the room who will jump in and we'll try and actually run some demos, play with some radios, do that sort of thing. So if possible, try and keep most of your questions until we get to that intentionally interactive part. If there's a specific thing I seem to be glossing over too fast and you just don't get it, stop me, please. But, you know, we'll see how we can manage time. So what are we talking about? Well, this is a block diagram of a typical, I chose data as opposed to audio kind of transceiver. And when we've built these things in the past, each of these little blocks on this diagram has been represented by a whole bunch of analog electronics. So if an antenna, you have some kind of a filter on the receive side, you have these little things that look like triangles or gain stages or amplifiers, another filter. You have some oscillator, you mix it with the incoming signal to reduce the effective frequency of the signal to something you can deal with. You filter it again, you got some more gain, you demodulate it in some interesting way, and what you get out, if it's a data receiver, are bits, you know, ones and zeros represented by high and low voltages on a wire or something like that. On the transmit side, you do sort of the reverse. You in effect, modulate the signal, you mix it back up, you amplify it, you filter it, and so forth. The problem is that the performance and the behavior of this system are both constrained in sort of absolute performance terms by the quality of all of the analog components in that whole chain. In other words, from the time the signal comes in the antenna until it comes out over there, every piece of analog electronics that it has to transit ends up having the ability to add noise to the signal, to distort the waveform, all those sorts of things. And also, it's constrained in function, because if you design this to have a particular filter with a particular bandwidth, a particular center frequency, and so forth, if your regulatory agency decides next year that thing you're trying to do should happen 100 megahertz farther up the frequency band, you get to start over. At minimum, you have to retune your filter. Maybe you have to throw it away and build a new one. And so while this is a conceptual model that still is something we talk about a lot, from a implementation standpoint, what this whole software-defined radio thing is about is trying to convert that into something more like this. Okay? The idea is, let's get as much of the specialized and customized hardware out of radio and communication systems as possible and replace it with software. And in order to do that, you always still have to have some little bit of electronics out there. You know, you may want a little bit of filtering to get rid of out-of-band signals that may be strong enough that they would, you know, cause images and other forms of interference and make it hard for you to receive your signal. You probably want some gain if you have a long cable between the antenna and the first stage of the A to D converter. You don't want all the noise that you might accumulate on that cable affecting the quality of your received signal and so forth. But fundamentally, as little electronics as possible, an analog to digital converter, now it's all just numbers. And everything after that is something that we get to control in software. On the transmit side, same thing. In a perfect world, you'd have a digital analog converter that could sync infinite current, you'd plug it straight into an antenna, and boom, you know, you'd have a big bodacious signal. Doesn't really work that way. Digital analog converters have physical limitations that mean that you almost always want some kind of filtering after that converter, and you want some kind of amplification to get signals up to some, you know, useful real-world kind of levels before you put them out the antenna. But again, the notion is you ought to be able to design these RF front-end pieces to be very simple and very flexible compared to a system in that sort of traditional analog model. And you ought to be able to do all of the modulation schemes, all of the tuning, frequency, interference rejection, all that kind of good stuff, do it in software where it's malleable, where you can experiment, innovate, and all of a sudden, you know, these complex, expensive radios become little, you know, specialized I/O peripherals, and we get to hack on the rest. So what can you do with this? Well, obviously, you can do any sort of conventional radio stuff. In fact, some of the demos that we think we can actually pull off in the limited time we have today are very conventional radio sorts of things. I mean, I could set up and run a megabit GMFSK signal across the room, and you all go ho-hum, because after all, your Wi-Fi cards go faster than that. The fact that you could, you know, put a big amplifier on it, put an antenna on the roof, and get, you know, hundreds of kilometers out of that same signal just wouldn't be impressive, because I can't actually demo that part. But, you know, receiving some local broadcast stations or something is a little more tractable. It's a little easier to understand. This really can be the world's most expensive, yet perhaps the world's coolest FM broadcast receiver. But even when you're doing conventional radio stuff, you get all of that, you know, flash reprogrammable sort of coolness, this notion that you can update it, enhance it, you can fix bugs, you can add new features, you can retune the performance if somebody comes up with a better signal processing algorithm and so forth. There's another interesting thing that happens, particularly when we're talking about data communications, and particularly when we're talking about data communications where robustness matters. And that is that it's a little recognized outside of the communications world fact that you can trade the amount of bandwidth or time off against the amount of power that you have to achieve a given bits per second effective throughput across the channel. If you go back and read Shannon's writings and other folks of his ilk from, you know, Bell Labs back in the 60s and 70s, they understood way back then that there was this sort of three-way trade-off between how much bandwidth the signal occupies, how much time you have to send a given piece of information, and how much power you need. And traditionally, most of our regulatory agencies regulate the power level and they regulate the bandwidth, and they only leave us with sort of time to play with as the thing that we can control. This is why you get modems with different data rates over phone lines and things like this. The phone line has a finite bandwidth. There's a limit to how much power you can pump down that phone line and so forth. But if you are working on, you know, little wireless interfaces between devices, you really can play with this. You can go to ultra-wideband kinds of approaches where you consume a huge amount of frequency and you spread across that frequency. And you really can sometimes use a heck of a lot less power and cause less interference by consuming more bandwidth. This is counterintuitive to people with a traditional radio kind of background working in communications regulatory agencies, and it's part of why this whole political thing gets challenging, which I'll talk about in a bit. Spectrum monitoring, I already mentioned, you can do things like, you know, receive the entire FM broadcast band all at once and record it. Or in the amateur radio world, you can receive and record all of the transmissions on all of the amateur radio repeaters in a given frequency band all at once, which is really interesting for doing occupancy studies to figure out if people are actually using those things, being able to go back later and figure out if people are doing inappropriate things, all that kind of stuff. You can build radios, this whole concept of cognitive radio. If you've ever had a look inside an emergency services vehicle, you know, an ambulance or particularly police in the United States, some of the folks that are doing search and rescue up in the mountains in Colorado have to have, you know, radios so they can talk on the police bands, and radios so they can talk to the fire guys, and radios so they can talk to the defense forces and all these sorts of things. Because of historical reasons, they tend to have different frequency allocations, they use different modulation schemes, they have all sorts of different regulatory requirements. But at the end of the day, I've been in, you know, Suburbans riding up through the mountains west of Pikes Peak where there were no less than 11 radios and 11 microphones in the vehicle on the off chance that the driver needed to be able to talk to somebody in any of these different agents. Well, I hate to be this way, but, you know, we could just have one box that had a flexible front end and a flexible transmission side and do all of that stuff in software, and you'd radically reduce the complexity. You'd make it more likely that if, you know, the fire department over there got a change in their frequency allocations, that all of a sudden everybody who needed to be able to communicate with them could, you know, update the software in their radio and be prepared to deal with it without having to wait until somebody could get inside and rip the box up and put another one in, et cetera, et cetera. I love this quote from one of my ham radio friends who said that used SDR-1000, this particular model piece of software-defined radio stuff I'll show you a little later, says used ones just don't exist, because you get a brand new radio every time you download a new version of the software. And that's just a neat idea. It's a neat concept, particularly for folks in the ham radio community who will spend an infinite amount of money on the things they care about, but who are fundamentally pretty cheap. Sorry, I only have a 3-meter dish. I don't have a 30-meter dish yet. However, I have friends in Europe with 30-meter dishes, and I love visiting them. yeah, we'll get to that later. Oh, get ahead of myself. That's not nice. It's really not nice. Distracting me like that. 30-meter dish, yeah. So GNU Radio, what is GNU Radio? Well, it's a software toolkit for building and deploying these software-defined radio things. Now, what do I mean by software-defined radio? How many of you, at some point in history, the EE education or something, had a class called digital signal processing or something like that? Oh, cool. So software-defined radio is just the application of digital signal processing techniques to this whole idea of radio. And so, you know, what you thought you were supposed to be paying attention to in class would actually still be useful if you remembered any of it. So, and books like Signals and Systems and the Oppenheim and Schaefer Digital Signal Processing are still on my shelf, and I still actually pull them out once in a while. I'm trying to remember what I was supposed to learn in class years ago. But, you know, what can you do with this? What's it good for? Well, you can learn about this whole digital signal processing thing. You can learn a lot about communication systems. The GNU Radio distribution has an interesting set of examples in the examples directory. And if you pop those open and take a look at them, you can become an expert on things like how FM broadcast receivers actually work. And you can go, wow, you know, that's 20 lines of Python code, and that's a lot of parts in that box over there. So. And of course, it takes an awful lot to make 20 lines of Python do something really useful, but the reality is that when we're hacking and playing, it's the level of complexity we have to deal with that constrains our ability to imagine new stuff and to innovate and play around. So it's a good thing. And you really can create all kinds of new stuff and just explore. And that's what, to me, is so incredibly groovy about all this stuff. So just briefly, the architecture and implementation of GNU Radio, it uses this data flow abstraction, so you sort of have directed graphs of the flow of information through the system. I'll show you how that gets hooked up. All the gory signal processing work is instantiated in a bunch of C++ blocks. You don't have to write any of those if you don't want to. If you think the digital signal processing part is the cool part, or if you want to do something that nobody's ever written a block for before, then yes, you get to dive in and figure out how that works. But most people end up just stitching these existing signal processing blocks together to create communication systems based on those blocks using the Python stuff. And I'll show you some. That's as far as we're going to try and go today. Believe me, I'm not going to try and write DHT code in front of you. That's something best, you know, done at home and private. And it's really pretty easy, and the body of examples, as I said, keeps growing. Everything I'm going to show you today is actually out of the GNU Radio examples directory. So, in fact, if you want to play along at home and you're running Debian, Etch, or SID, you can do an apt-get install GNU Radio, and you will have the code that I have on my machine. Exactly, because I'm the maintainer of those packages, and I actually run my packaged version. Yeah, that's okay. And if you don't want to follow along at home, that's just fine, too. So these signal processing blocks all sort of have input and output streams. These streams have signatures. I don't know, instead of talking about it, well, let's just look at some of this later. So here's an example. This is an actual piece of functional GNU Radio code. It's sort of the hello world of the GNU Radio context. Do any of you immediately understand what's going on here enough to shout out what this does? Or should I walk you through and show you? Okay. So there's a little bit of goof up at the top, the usual Python stuff about importing the GNU Radio, and in this case we're going to actually generate some audio, so we import the audio stuff as well. We set a sampling frequency of 32 kilohertz and a magic amplitude number, just something modest. Then this is where it gets interesting. We actually are defining a GNU Radio flow graph, which is this fundamental sort of unit of stuff that happens in GNU Radio, and we're assigning some sources to be signal sources. These are oscillators, in effect, out of the GNU Radio object library, specifying what the sampling frequency is, and that we want it to be a sine wave, and we're specifying the frequency of the sine wave, and we're instantiating two of those. We define a destination, which is a sync in the audio library, also at the sampling frequency. And then we do the really simple thing. We connect them up. We hook the two sources to the destination, the two inputs on the destination. We hand that back In the main, we just build the graph, we start it, and we let it run until the person hits enter and it stops. So. Yes, exactly. And this particular sync happens to have several inputs, and we just use the 0th and 1th input of it. And yes, there's documentation on all of these objects and big docs that you can mess. We can look at later if you want. So, so just to prove that this is, can I actually do this? Yeah, but I have to select, right, I have to get in here. I'm just going to prove that this is actually a live example. And it got all the characters? Yeah, cool. Okay. And I think I lost my audio thingy over there. Hopefully it's turned up. If you can hear that or not. That's, U.S. style telephone dial tone. And yes, you can go on and do the rest of the blue box if you want. No, it's mixing them. There are lots of things that you could choose to do. This is, as I said, just sort of a hello world. And frankly, I'll explain in a few minutes. There's different things, sort of different classes of things you can try to do in the name of software-defined radio. If you don't have any specialized hardware, you can do a lot of really interesting and cool stuff just using the sound card in your machine, particularly if you have some existing receiver, a scanner, something like that, that you can feed the audio from into your machine and then start playing around trying to decode and demodulate whatever that thing is that you're... there's cool things you can do without buying lots of expensive hardware, but of course, it's fun to have these. Stop it. Not now. I have a few pictures of the shed later, so... Yeah, we'll get to it. No pictures of 30-meter dishes, but I have some of a 3-meter dish. It would just not be complete without that. So I mentioned that there's this political layer that you need to pay attention to. It's really part of the reason I like talking about software-defined radio is that I think there's this intriguing tension that's going on between people who want to innovate and reinvent and do incredibly cool stuff and people who are tasked with sort of maintaining law and order and consistency of the world in which we live. So let's go back for just a second to that example I mentioned of a public safety vehicle running around, right? Now, it sounds like an incredibly cool thing to apply software-defined radio technology to allow a legitimate emergency worker to be able to pop up and interact with any of their peers they might need to across organizational boundaries, right? Well, what happens if someone malicious has access to the same technology and can jam or interfere with all of those services simultaneously? That's not good, right? So it's not that this is a really simple, free my bits even when they're over the air, please kind of issue. We legitimately, as a society that wants to function well, have to recognize that there are tensions here that will have to be resolved, by intelligent people thinking through this and figuring out where the boundaries ought to be over time. But I just want to point out that, that it ought to be possible to strike reasonable balances. There are forces in the world who would like to regulate the ability to purchase and own analog to digital converters. They would like to have restriction mechanisms in the A to D. I'm not kidding you. This has been in the U.S. Congress as, legislature under discussion, as legislation under discussion. Fortunately, it kind of got killed. But there are people whose business interests will cause them to ask for and expect to be able to get completely unreasonable things. And if you understand a little bit about the underlying technology and what's at stake, maybe you will actually care enough to help, keep an eye out for those sorts of things, help educate the people that need to know and so forth. So part of the motivation that caused the GNU Radio project to come into existence was this whole high-definition TV broadcast flag thing. And the notion there was that there was going to be a regulatory requirement that if a particular bit in the header of a high-definition over-the-air signal was set, that equipment sold to consumers would not agree to record that. In other words, you would have a digital video recorder that would refuse to record anything as a matter of legal requirement that had a particular bit set in the header. Now, is that a good idea or not? opinions may differ, but when you take that regulatory mechanism and you intersect it with things like the Digital Millennium Copyrights Act, which makes it illegal in the U.S. to reverse engineer a encryption or content protection mechanism, then you're in an interesting situation where you can see the bit, you can see all the rest of the bits, but legally you have to adhere to the bit, and if you publish a method for ignoring the bit, you're probably in really bad trouble. Okay? This just seems like the kind of thing that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. So, one of the early goals of the GNU Radio project was, let's implement a complete software implementation of a high-definition TV receiver and put it out there before the broadcast flag went into effect. Therefore, there would be prior art, and you wouldn't have to engage in an illegal reverse engineering of the specification in order to be able to do this. Okay? Now, the good news is the courts overruled this whole situation by saying that the FCC is empowered to regulate what happens with signals that are being transmitted over the airwaves, but they do not have the authority to regulate what happens after the signal has been received. However, that of course immediately caused the Motion Picture Industry Association folks and so forth to start lobbying their Congress critters for new laws. And I don't know where this is going to go. It's going to continue to be a battle as long as there are financial interests on both sides of the equation, right? And that's just how things work. But at the same time, there are, you know, as I've already mentioned, there are sort of good things that can be done and bad things that can be done. I don't think this is simple. One of the most challenging areas, which in fact Evan Moglen even referenced in his keynote presentation at LCA 2 years ago in Canberra, is this whole issue around how wireless networking devices work. Many of you have notebooks with inbuilt wireless interfaces that you have to download a firmware object to before they'll function with your Linux device driver. The reason for this is that regulatory agencies around the world don't want that device to be completely in the hands of the end user. They don't want all of the knobs to be turnable. They want to have some control over what frequencies can be set, how power control works, and things like this, in order to ensure that consumers can expect that all of these things do seamlessly just sort of work together in the way that people expect. The problem, of course, is that that means that the industry has interpreted these rules as meaning that they can't give us the definitions of how the hardware works, because then we might know how to turn the knobs the regulatory agencies don't want us to. And in effect, they have hidden, you know, some of how the hardware actually works inside these pieces of firmware, which we then are just supposed to use and sort of interact with at the API above that. It may, in fact, be exactly the most practical way at the moment to balance the requirements of that are perceived by the regulatory agencies and what we would like as open source developers. But it's kind of a shame when you get to experimenting with entirely different models of wireless communication that you can't just take advantage of all of the features of the hardware to go off and run experiments and do things like that. So I think even in this case, over time, this deserves a certain amount of attention and thought by intelligent people to figure out what actually makes sense. And in fact, the GNU Radio guys did achieve their objective. They were able to do, this is actually a frame from an over-the-air high-definition TV broadcast that was received all the way from antenna into A to D converter. Everything else, including the HDTV stream decoding and all that stuff, is done in software. So, you know, instance proof of it. The current GNU Radio code base doesn't focus on this because since the broadcast flag thing got sort of set aside for the moment, it's a whole lot easier actually to go buy an HDTV, you know, receiver card that has all this done in hardware and just get the transport stream into your MythBox that way. With kudos to the guys that had this room just before me. So, okay, so that's, I'm not going to spend a whole lot more time talking about the regulatory thing. I just want to make sure that all of you understand that this is not a clear either-or kind of situation. We will forever be stuck trying to find where the right balance points are between the needs of people trying to maintain sort of reasonable structure of the radio spectrum and people who want to experiment and innovate. So this leads us to sort of the part that I think is practical and interesting about all this. And it's, okay, fine. So you have this cute block diagram that shows an antenna, a little amplification, and an A to D converter. Well, where do you get good A to D converters from, and how do you hook them up to your computer, and how do you actually get data in and out of the machine? Well, fundamentally, what we need is analog to digital and digital to analog conversion, and we may need to do some up or down conversion depending on the RF frequency bands of interest. And there are really two main approaches that people take. A lot of the hobby work on software-defined radio stuff is actually being done by amateur radio operators around the world. And a lot of them are interested in doing cool things that are sort of like or evolutions of existing communications modes that are fundamentally very narrowband. You know, we're talking about, you know, CW signals can be, you know, very narrow. People are accustomed to a few hundred hertz filters. Listening to CW with a 5 hertz filter is really pretty cool. Morse code using continuous wave transmission, i.e. you turn the transmitter on and off and the guy on the other end basically hears a tone or not in his receiver. Some people really love it. Some of us are not so thrilled. It is, after all, a digital communication method. There are also, you know, existing analog voice-oriented communications modes like AM, FM, which are very similar to, you know, tuning AM and FM on your broadcast receivers, but you get to transmit to, and frequently they're with narrower bandwidths to fit more, you know, conversations in a given chunk of radio spectrum and to more efficiently take advantage of the power that's being used. But my point is that if you're working with signals that fall into that general category, where the bandwidth of the signal in question is less than a couple hundred kilohertz, then a sound card interface actually, you know, sound cards actually include analog to digital and digital to analog converters that can be very good. They can also be really lousy, and I'll show you an example of that here just shortly. But then if like me, you're interested in doing other things, which include wider bandwidth signals or looking at lots of narrow bandwidth signals all at once, then you'd like to be able to grab a bigger chunk of frequency spectrum to play with at a time than you can get out of the A to D converters that are built into sound cards. And so then you need these sort of direct, you know, data conversion interfaces. Historically, there's been a lot of stuff that was made for PCI bus, but now most of it's gone to USB. So let's talk just a little bit about sound card interfacing. You know, these sound cards all run at, from an RF standpoint, relatively low sampling rates. Now, you can actually treat these as being either sort of at the baseband modulation area or as actually being sort of at an IF, depending on what you're trying to do. But fundamentally, it's sort of constrained by the capabilities that are required to provide consumer or professional quality audio. And if you go to play in this direction, it's good to be aware of what some of those limits are. This is really good for doing in audio input and output things. In the ham radio world, there are a lot of people that play around with very simple interfaces between, for example, the sound ports on a notebook computer and some little transceiver. Do you have an 817 or something with you here? So Hugh Blemings, one of my good friends from IBM in Canberra, who is also a ham and brought some toys along, he's going to pull out a little sort of commercially packaged ham radio transceiver that a number of us carry around with us when we're traveling. Yeah, so this has batteries built in. It covers every ham band from DC to, what, 370 centimeters. Yeah, so through 450 megahertz. Maximum of 5 watts output power. It's relatively low power radio, but it's very cool. And is this your sound interface here?
Yeah.
So, you know, he's got a little box with probably a little level setting stuff, maybe an isolation transformer, and a bunch of connectors on it. There's a cute mini DIN that happens to be the same pinout on these, or the same mechanical connector that's used on PS2 mice, so you can cut the cable off an old dead mouse and use that. Looks like you actually bought a nice new connector, Hugh. Yeah, it's Christmas, yeah, right. And then these are just, you know, audio connectors to go into the mic in and headphone out on a sound card. And then we often use a serial port to get, you know, a pin, you know, one of the handshaking lines to use to turn the transmitter on and off. But this is a pretty typical thing a lot of ham radio folks would use. And you can do really cool stuff like keyboard-to-keyboard chat with people down here from the U.S. I actually sat at my parents' beach house on the Outer Banks of North Carolina with a radio similar to that, but actually running at about 20 watts, with a wire antenna thumbtacked into the railing on the back of the deck, so it's about 8 or 10 feet off the sand. And I had really pleasant conversations with folks in New Zealand and New Caledonia. So this is quite possible. And this is, there's no internet involved, by the way. That was just, you know, my RF transmitted, the guy on the other end heard it. We're using sound card software to decode it and had a good time. And that's this mode called PSK31, which we probably won't be able to do a really live demo of today because, yeah, I might have some screenshots to show you what that's like. They're also, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I haven't actually seen any of the 1-bit 2 megahertz stuff used. I'm going to show you some 192 kilobit or kilohertz codecs shortly. Yeah, and I got to be honest with you, the problem that you have right now is that when you get to these higher performance codecs in existing audio devices, you can typically only buy them with a gazillion pro audio features that you're not going to use, which puts them in the over the $1,000 range. So there's actually a project I'll mention briefly in a few minutes that's trying to take one of the best codecs from that set and put it into something cheap and affordable for folks like us to play with. This is the guts of one of these SDR1000s, which I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about, but it's probably the best example of a product you can just go buy to do really cool software-defined radio stuff around narrowband signals in the amateur radio HF communication bands. The receiver performance of this software-defined radio is constrained by the signal-to-noise ratio of the audio card that you're using. So if you have a sufficiently high-quality audio interface on your computer in one of these, which is a few hundreds of dollars, you will have better HF receiver performance in the ham radio band than even the most expensive prepackaged ham radio transceivers. The Tentec Orions and the biggest Yaesu and Icom and Kenwood machines can't touch the performance of this with a good sound card. And the user interface on this, you know, can be sort of anything you want it to be. This one's kind of interesting because you get sort of the entire frequency band, you know, up there as a little spectrum display. You can see the, if you're in the middle of a contest and you're looking for another signal, you can just see it, click on it, and boom, you're on that frequency. You can dial the filter to the right bandwidth. You can, anyway, you get the idea. It's a kind of flexibility that doesn't exist with a hardware radio that just has a frequency display and so forth. And if you try to get these kinds of features in a pre-built, you know, commercial amateur radio transceiver, it's incredibly expensive because they're replicating all the stuff that's in your notebook and lots of other things in a very expensive package. Mike? What's that? $300 US. Well, the guys that ship that SDR1000 are very fond of the InAudio Delta 44 and Delta 66 cards. There, in fact, has been work done by Leif Asbrink, who does the Linrad software, on how to mod those cards to make them substantially better. It turns out that even though they used a really good codec, they skimped on the quality and capacity of the various capacitors and the power supply decoupling and so forth. And so if you're obsessive compulsive about this stuff today, you go and buy one of the InAudio Delta 44s, you go find the mod site that Leif's put up, and you step through and replace all the components with the ones he suggests, and it works like four times as well. So. It's all Linux. The SDR1000 software stack was originally done in Visual Basic, and it has been completely reworked by a couple of folks who are serious GNU Radio contributors as well. Today, it's all of the stuff is moving towards Python as the UI, various other things being used to implement the signal processing engine underneath. With GNU Radio, it's C++. With these guys, it's varies depending on who you're talking to. And yes, that interface will run just fine on both Windows and Linux, though the Windows stuff is called PowerSDR, and it's always like a click ahead because most of the people that are Linux-based folks are more interested for some reason in wideband or other things that cause them to be, I just stopped pushing the wrong buttons here, cause them to be more interested in the wideband interfaces. So most of the narrowband stuff has a Windows affinity for some reason. Okay, so wideband stuff. For a while, you had to go buy PCI-style A to D and D to A cards. They're really expensive because these are made for typically customers in things like industrial automation solutions, and they just don't care how much it costs, so they'll spend money on it. You still need to have some kind of an RF front end because that's just the analog to digital converter or DDA converter, and you still have to condition that to the real world. So there's been this whole spate of things that have come out using USB 2.0 interfaces, almost all using the same USB 2.0 interface chip, which is a Cypress FX2 part. This is one of the first examples of this called the SSRP from David Carr. It uses this little USB 2.0 prototyping interface board with one of the Cypress parts on it. That's a USB-D connector over there to give you a sense of scale. And then this is the daughter card, one of which I have here. In fact, I'll be happy to pass this around for folks to look at. Just please make sure it comes back to me at the end of the session. Well, it's kind of, yeah, it's two pieces. Yeah, it's mine. Please be gentle with it. And this was actually came to me as a kit, which I, you know, soldered parts down on. No, surface mount's not scary. It just looks scary.
What sample rate are they operating
at? Well, this one's configurable. In fact, it has a socketed oscillator, and it's not. It's configurable by you pull out the oscillator and put a different one in. So whatever you use as the oscillator is what it's going to sample at. In this case, it's 6 megahertz. And in fact, there's a little piece of code that you can run against just a little USB board to figure out how fast your computer's USB 2 interface really goes. First generation USB 2.0 systems often use the chipset from NEC. It's really slow. You know, you can get a few megabits out of it, but not much. Certainly not 480 like you're supposed to be able to. It's not at all unreasonable to be simultaneously doing 32 megabit in and out on these cards. And this one has no real smarts out here. It's just an A to D converter piping the data through a FIFO into the USB 2 bus. But it's cute. It's cheap. If you don't have a license to be able to transmit on ham bands or things like that, it's a receive-only kind of thing. There are other people that have done similar stuff. This is another board that's almost identical. This one has, this is done by, I can't remember if he's in Russia or Argentina. I get the guys confused. This one has an analog devices, A to D converter, whereas the one that's going around has a linear technologies part. That's the same FX2 microcontroller. This is the other side. You see it's just some bypassing parts and an oscillator and so forth. And at the end of the day, this again allows you to basically take an analog input and sample it at, you know, up to 16 or 24 megahertz or something like that and get the samples into your machine to play with in software. And all of these little boards, anything you use in the FX2 in this flavor that you find out on the net probably has or is about to have a GNU radio driver. So it's not hard to deal with. Okay, so then there's the boards that I've been playing with a lot. In fact, I had a little influence on the guy who originally did this, convincing him to actually go do it, which I am really pleased to have been able to do. This is called the USRP, which stands for the Universal Software Radio Peripheral. And how universal it is can be argued. But the basic idea here is that you have a USB 2.0 interface, a big honking FPGA in the middle of the board to offload some of the processing steps that are completely common across a lot of applications to reduce the amount of data you're actually shoving back and forth over the USB interface and give you kind of a hybrid solution, except the code running in the FPGA here is you get all the source code to that, and while the tools are not open source, they are freely accessible to reprogram this particular Altera part. So you can hack on what's in the FPGA too if you want. In fact, I think, Keith, you were mentioning that there are some classes, university classes now, that among other things are writing FPGA code that's going to be used in these boards. They have a bunch of really fast A to D and D to A channels. For those of you who can't see the board from down here real well, this is what the motherboard looks like with these four socket sites, two receive and two transmit sockets into which you can plug different daughter cards. The kind of stuff that goes on in the FPGA I don't really have time to explain signal processing fundamentals to you today, but there's basically oscillators and mixers and this concept of decimation and interpolation where you can have the A to D converter running at some high sample rate and then in effect in the FPGA be sort of picking every nth sample to actually send back up the wire to the PC. So if you only care about 100 kilohertz of bandwidth right now and your A to D is running at 64 megahertz, it's actually handy to use a little piece of hardware to, you know, rip it down to a more manageable data stream before you bring it up to the PC. This is what one of the boards looks like with some of the minimalist transmit and receive daughter cards on it. The one that I have here has one each of the basic receive and basic transmit daughter cards. They have a lot of connectors just to allow you to get to all the different pins. But the only active parts on here are some little isolation transformers between the A to D converter inputs and outputs and these SMA connectors. So when I plug something like this in, which is just a little coax adapter to a BNC connector and one of these cheap Radio Shack telescoping antennas, it really is fundamentally just hooking a piece of wire to the front end of the A to D converter. Because after all, an antenna is nothing but a piece of wire cut to a particular length to be resonant at a given frequency. And so what I have right now is, in effect, just a piece of wire, albeit an expensive piece of wire, hooked to the input of that A to D converter, and we'll carry on with that in just a moment. Actually, I'll do that right now before we jump too far ahead. I'm going to show you one, or try and show you one demonstration of this stuff actually working live before I jump ahead to talk to some other hardware. So this is a USB 2.0 peripheral. Uses little wall wart for power. And when I plug it in, the LED starts flashing, which is always a good thing. And a couple seconds later, another LED wiggles, and now the LED is blinking slower, which is also a really good thing. The thing about these Cypress USB 2.0 microcontrollers is that they come up basically stupid, saying, I'm a little Cypress part, and I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. And so part of packaging the GNU Radio stuff for Linux was gluing into the hot plug UDEV universe so that one of these shows up on the bus, you can have the firmware that needs to be put into that microcontroller to light up the USRP and make it work be automatically downloaded. That firmware, by the way, is also 100% open source. It uses the small device C compiler, SDCC, to build the firmware to download to the 8051-ish core in the FX2. and then once you've downloaded the firmware and told it to run, it resets, and in the process, it does a disconnect from the USB bus and then reconnects and says, hi, I'm a USRP 2.0. Would you please do something with me? So, just to prove that, fire up USB. Yeah, it's working. Okay. Yeah, so it's USRP Rev 2 up there in the upper corner. And we can go to user, share. I should probably blow this up a little bit, shouldn't I? Is that enough or one more? Can you see that back there? It's hard. It's actually, I'm at a sufficiently oblique angle here. It's actually kind of hard to see. Oh, caps, I'll have to get out of my way. Hello. Oh, right. Okay, so this is a bunch of example code that comes with. You can see these, a bunch of these have been compiled, but that sort of doesn't matter. Let's pick one. Let's just try and do a little FM broadcast reception, see if it works. I haven't actually tried this one up here. I don't even know if I really need to run this as sys on here, because I haven't tried this, but this should bring up an FM receiver. And it did. Where am I likely to find something? One of five something? Of course, I just got this.
How high
This particular example is configured for the FM broadcast band. Well, I put one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What the hell, man? Gain is up. Yeah, this is much more of a Faraday cage than I thought. I found six or seven nice stations just trimming around in the hotel room this morning. Well, there's some carrier sitting, there's some, or stir or something. You can see it as I step across. Yeah, it's probably just a spur. In fact, these all look like spurs. I don't see anything that looks like a broadcast FM station. Now, of course, you have to understand that the sensitivity of this is really lousy because we don't have any gain in front of the A to D converter. But normally I can find something. Well, okay, we'll come back to this after we're done talking about things. But that's the general idea is I'm just running a little piece of Python code, and I'll let you take a quick look at that one, too. You saw the Hello World example earlier. This one's not actually a whole heck of a lot more complicated. As usual, the user interface dominates the amount of code that's involved. Yeah, a bunch of calculations of rates and so forth. You know, here's where the audio sync is being set up. There are a few more parameters being handed to that than you saw before. Again, mostly UI kind of junk. Here's where the FFTs are being run. An FFT is a fast Fourier transform. For those of you who don't do signal processing stuff, that allows you to take a series of samples of an RF spectrum in time, run them through this algorithm, and now you have a view of it in frequency. So you can see the carrier signals at different frequencies and try and decode them and so forth. Again, you know, trying to explain signal processing is probably beyond the amount of time I've got today, but this is all a little horky on a small window like this. But there is, if you look through this, I think, you know, if you read Python, there's just not a whole lot of stuff going on in there. It's mostly user interface glue. Okay, so that's the USRP, and we'll try and play with that a little bit more after we get through the rest of the stuff. A couple of more examples of hardware that I want to breeze through really quickly, and then I want to show you a couple of the projects that I'm currently involved with. There's this thing called HPSDR, the High Performance Software Defined Radio Project. They're really trying to apply the same sort of all-volunteer, shared cooperative design methodology that we use in open source to designing open hardware things. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a bunch of geeks having a good time building SDR components. This is one of the first things they've built, which doesn't look a whole lot like a radio, and it doesn't actually have any software. It's a backplane for plugging the various cards into. This is actually available as a kit now through Tapper, which I'll mention in a little bit. Probably the first interesting thing is this card, which you'll notice it also has a big Altera FPGA part on it and one of these little Cypress USB 2.0 microcontrollers. This is the card that plugs into that backplane that gives you a USB 2.0 interface to some computer as a host and implements, if you will, sort of everything except the A to D's and D to A's that's part of something like the USRP. And again, it's all, you know, completely open design. And then, which one is this? Oh, yeah, this is another board that's being worked on that brings together sound card bits and pieces, which will also allow you to end up having what amounts to a USB 2.0 to sound card interface with really high quality sound characteristics. So what's so important about having a sound card? Well, I already talked about the fact that there's this whole class of software-defined radio experimentation that's being done using sound card interfaces. The problem is, as I mentioned, the performance of those solutions is fundamentally constrained by the performance of the audio cards. And in the process of looking at the performance of a bunch of these 192 kilohertz A to D converters, these are the kind of sort of frequency response plots that were being seen. So this is zero, and this is the two channels in effect being used to look at, you know, a double the chunk of bandwidth. And what you'll notice is there's a fairly ugly spike around zero. In other words, their response down at very low frequencies is lousy. And you'll notice that they're starting to go fairly far away from a linear response as you get up in frequency. This one's really hideous. Now, it turns out if you're listening to audio, you don't actually hear that. It doesn't actually bother you because your brain sort of has a natural response curve there anyway. And as long as it says 192 kilohertz as a consumer, you're going to buy it and you're going to feel really great about it. And that's what a really good codec looks like. You notice nice and flat all the way out to the edges, just a tiny little spike right at zero. It's really hard to do this at zero, so you kind of just have to deal with that. But the problem is this particular codec chip is, to the best of my knowledge, only available in pro audio kinds of sound cards that are in the $600 US and up kind of range. And so that's the problem that these guys are really trying to solve first, is this notion that it would be really nice to have this kind of quality audio codec with the USB 2.0 interface that people could use for doing SDR experimentation with narrowband signals without having to break the bank. There are a lot of other things they're doing. This board is faster than the A to Ds and D to As that are on the USRP, so one of these boards combined with that controller board would give you an entirely different kind of combination. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. It's hot. It's hot. It's a hot chip. Yeah, and there's all sorts of other projects. I'm not going to obsess on the various parts of this. HPSDR.org, it's on my last slide. The slides will be up on the site, you know, sometime today, I assume. Assuming I actually remember to give them to them at the end of the talk. And you can go chase this stuff down. It's not like there's an organization out there. This is just like an open source project. It's a bunch of people who have interesting ideas who've chosen to collaborate together, are agreeing on standards for what the backplane signal should be, how things should connect together. There's some organizations out there that are going to help bring things together. They're also interested in precise timing and building discipline oscillators. If you're trying to, you know, bounce signals off the moon and have the guy on the other end have any chance of finding that really weak signal, knowing that you're both on exactly the same frequency is really handy. And this is the kind of technology that helps make that and many other related sorts of things happen. Prototyping tools. This organization called TAPRT, which was originally Tucson Amateur Packet Radio in the U.S., it's been around for a long time. Folks in the ham radio world tend to have heard of it. This was the organization that built kits of some of the early packet radio interface boxes and so forth. They have sort of agreed to become involved in this HPSDR community and help make some combinations of kits and pre-assembled pieces available. So it's not just a sort of vapor project out there of people playing around. These things will actually be available to go pick up and play with. And then there are two areas that I want to talk about just briefly that have to do with applications I personally am involved in around software-defined radio. One is in the amateur satellite community. And in this case, spacecraft. When we build an amateur radio satellite, what is it that we're actually building? Well, it's basically an orbiting radio relay system where we transmit signals up to the satellite. They're received, cleaned up, processed a little bit, and retransmitted on some other frequency so that we can, in effect, repeat signals through that satellite that other people can listen to, and then they can talk back to us and we're able to communicate. Traditionally, the way this has all worked is there's been an analog signal processing block in the middle here. This has a number of interesting problems. One of the ones that has mattered a lot to us in recent times is that as people have become able to build personal transmitting stations for communicating with these amateur satellites that have very high-powered transmitters, we can end up in a situation where you have a mixture of very high power and very low power signals competing for that transponder at the same time. The very high powered signals, in effect, win out and get all of the power in the downlink. And you get this huge sort of differential of what's actually possible that's greater than what it ought to be because this signal conditioning chain just can't deal with this huge dynamic range difference between the weaker and poorer signals and the strong ones. This is an example. Sure. Right.
Is there a
device or software that can change
the low power signal to high power signal or change the low switch to low power?
Yes, the problem is that.
High power signal to low power signal. So that the one that they want to pick up can be picked up?
Yes, the difficulty is that in a service, this is hard to explain without spending a lot of time, but in the amateur radio world, individual operators have complete control over how their stations are constructed and how they operate. And so you can't assume that someone will just turn down the power on their transmitter if they need less power in order to communicate. The consequence of which is that at something like a satellite or even a terrestrial repeater site, if a strong signal is arriving, that person can in effect capture the receiver, and they can so swamp the front end with energy that it just can't hear the weaker signals adjacent to it. And the problem is that person sort of wins. They're the ones who get communicated through this, and therefore it's sort of a self-fulfilling thing that if you behave badly, it actually works better, and that induces you to behave more badly, which makes it worse for the other users of the system. And traditionally, when we were flying analog transponders, like this one from Oscar 7, which is an interesting story in and of itself, the problem was that analog signal processing chain would just get overloaded. You know, the amount of energy being pumped into various components in the front end filters and so forth were just swamped, and there was really nothing you could do about it. And I won't spend time talking about HELOPs, even though I'd love to. So the idea that we have is to build satellite transponders in the future where that block is replaced with a digital signal conditioning system, and in effect, all of these pieces tied together operate as a software-defined transponder, sort of a combination of a software-defined receiver and a software-defined transmitter. And there are actually some prototypes that have been built demonstrating this concept. Out of curiosity, how many of you who are ham radio people in the room? A few? Have any of you other than me ever had the chance to go to the Dayton Ham Radio Convention in the U.S.? Oh, it's like the world's largest convention of amateur radio operators, all of whom are carrying radios around and trying to talk to each other. It is therefore one of the world's densest RF environments. And when you're when the AMSAT booth, that curtain in the back of the booth, on the back side of there were people demonstrating mobile HF amplifiers. And I did say demonstrating, okay? 600-watt HF mobile amplifiers with a whip antenna on a pole in the corner of the cube making international voice contacts from the exhibit hall floor. So the interesting thing is, this prototype of a software-defined transponder board was running in the AMSAT booth, and people in AMSAT were using it all weekend to chat to each other through the transponder. And it was just about the sweetest sounding thing with about an 85 dB effective dynamic range despite all of this crap going on around it. So I don't have time to explain all of the details of this. It's a fairly complicated block diagram. But it's all software, and it's all malleable, and we can experiment, and we can learn how to make things work better, and as we learn how to make them work better, we can tweak and improve. If the Navy puts up a new radar in San Diego on a frequency we didn't anticipate, we can code in the algorithm for clipping that out and making it just not be a problem for our users. And even better, we can do things like dynamically change the filtering characteristics so that if you're transmitting a signal that's too loud, no problem. We will notch you out of the passband. So bad behavior is rewarded by making it work less well for you. And, you know, the self-corrective thing. It's the old be careful what you incent because you will get it. Well, we can try and incent the right behaviors. Yeah. Of course we will. Yeah. In fact, I don't have time to talk about it now, but it is another one of my favorite topics. We had a major satellite that went on to have a very useful life after having an in-flight explosion in the propulsion system. because everything we do is completely reloadable and reprogrammable from the ground, and we were able to completely reconfigure the satellite to use the pieces that still worked effectively for several years. Yeah. Oscar 40. Yep. The problem with hypergolic fuels is that when they mix in the wrong places and go boom, it's... Okay. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that stuff. If you're interested, more information about what's going on in AMSAT will be in the slide deck that's on the website, and there's a URL pointing to the AMSAT project stuff at the end. I guess the one thing that I will mention... No, it's only 10 feet. Oh, wrong. So the other thing that I'm working on, which I've talked about at a couple of LCAs in the past, so I'm not going to, again, spend a whole lot of time talking about it. Feel free to go back and look at that. Look on my website where I actually went and downloaded the slide deck this morning so I could remember what I said. this is all about ham radio operators communicating with other ham radio stations by bouncing signals off the moon. Seems obvious, right? And for me, this has been one of those projects that brings together all these different hobbies that I think are exciting. I love metalworking and welding and machining and so forth, so I designed and built the Azel mount for a refurbed 3-meter TV reception dish myself, and I'm successfully pointing that to within about 0.15 degree in both axes anytime I want. it has a feed that I've built to put in front of that dish. I'll show you a picture of in just a moment using a design from one of my Slovenian friends that works really well. It's a home-built feed. All of the oscillators in this station are referenced to a GPS-synchronized HP high-performance oscillator from back when HP still made such things. I have one of these USRPs as my IF radio. I'm using a transverter from Down East Microwave to convert from 28 megahertz-ish up to 1296. That's because it's basically just oscillators, mixers, lots of filters and gain, which is the kind of stuff you want to have to do high-performance work on any given microwave band. Pretty decent preamp from a company called LNA Technologies. Right now I have about a 75-watt amplifier, which I have not actually tried to put on the dish yet. It's a long story about it being cold and in the middle of the night, and I decided that if I tried to hook that up, I'd probably kill it or me, and it was time to call it quits for the moment. And I'm working right now on a 500-watt water-cooled tube amplifier using a surplus French TV transmitting tube that I should have on the air soon. Yeah. Well, yeah, and my friends in Switzerland who have access to good three-phase power in residences are... happily running the TH347, which is good for 2.5 kilowatts. And they're the ones who have the 10-meter and bigger dishes. So that's my little 3-meter dish, and that's my just-turned-8 last Friday son, who has been my partner in crime on this particular project. Oh, yeah. Well, I was using this was when I first got the dish mounted, and I was using the battery and the tractor to run the 12-volt motors to do Azel positioning and see if it actually worked. And it's a good thing I did that because, well, there are a couple of things I had to redo. Anyway, so this is a much more recent picture, and this is here primarily to show the feed with the preamp and relay and stuff up in front of the dish. Here's a little... Oops, did I skip one? Maybe I didn't even put it in there. I thought I did. Yeah, I must have left it out. Okay. I thought I had a close-up of the stuff in front of the feed. This is what I do to keep it from being totally covered with snow this time of year. Plastic garbage bag and some duct tape. Works just fine as long as you remember to replace it a couple times a year because they do degrade in sunlight over time. And then there's this little shed at the base of the tower that the dish is adjacent to. This is the string of secondary preamp stages I used and a power sensor. The first thing I did was actually do sun noise measurements and all that sort of stuff. Oh, yeah, that's the little shed at the base of the tower. Just to give you some sense, that's about not quite 3 feet across and about 6 feet the other way. And, yes, I do go sit up in that in the middle of the night trying to make all this stuff work. You can see there's a concrete pad poured here. Part of the reason I haven't actually completed a contact is I decided it would be nice to have a little more floor space to, and a place that I could actually stand up in without banging my head. So I'm building a little addition on my shed. Well, you know, can't help it. This is the current stack of gear that's inside there. This is actually, I realized I never took any pictures when I had the full setup with the software-defined radio stuff. This is a commercial Japanese transceiver that operates on 1296 that I was using for some of the initial listening experiments. I have very successfully heard my Moonbounce buddies in Europe, in places like Germany and Switzerland and so forth, heard their signals off the moon, had no problem successfully copying them and all that sort of thing. I just haven't got the transmit side hooked up yet. So at this point, I'm going to sort of wrap up the presentation a bit, show you this list of URLs, and then for those of you that are interested, we have another quarter of an hour or so. I'd be happy to take some questions, and we'll try to demo a few bits and pieces if we can figure out why we're not getting RF here or pick something else to play with. So before we dive into that, any questions from anybody? Yes. I don't know much about the local rules here. In the U.S., we have now got a fairly simplified licensing system where there are really only sort of three classes of license, and I expect that to actually be reduced to two before. Very good. So if you're interested in getting an amateur radio license so that you can actually transmit to things like these satellites and play around with it, these guys would be happy to help you on local issues. I can certainly talk to you about what you have to do in the U.S. Most everything I've shown is possible in the U.S. with the lowest level license, the technician license. If the technician license confers essentially all privileges above 50 megahertz, which is where all this stuff happens, almost care about it. Not an
issue.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of folks are interested in doing non-voice type things. The USRP board, there's a, if you go out to the USRP site, well, at us.com, or the new radio site, follow around, there's a wiki and a mailing list. The GNU Radio mailing list has an intriguing group of participants. There are people using these and similar boards to do, you know, serious radio astronomy work and things like this. There are people doing, the first question everybody asks is, can I build a Wi-Fi radio with this? And the answer is, well, yes, of course, but why would you? this daughter card right here is a 2.4 gigahertz transceiver, and yes, USRP with that board is capable of doing at least 802.11b. The problem is that the folks who've actually hacked on them so far have gotten it sort of working just well enough to show that they can associate with an access point if nobody else is around and they can move some data. I'm not aware of anybody having taken it to the point where you would actually want to use it on access point being used by people you care about. there are portions of the standard having to do with power control and how different, you know, radios interact with each other, but I don't think any of those folks have actually bothered getting right yet. So it would be really antisocial, for example, to need to load that straight up on it here. Yeah, it's a completely uninteresting thing to do, frankly. Now, a much more interesting thing is that there has been some work on a really efficient, really good, you know, over a week length, 1 megabit. Bidirectional data stream kind of implementation. And that one actually, you know, it's all with software. It's no big deal to plug that in and route packets from the Linux kernel out, you know, over that interface and use it as an RF link between a couple of Linux machines and so forth. It may well be that people interested in doing rural sorts of networking things and stuff like that, other than just for other reasons, may find that it's interesting to use that kind of technology to be able to experiment with modulation schemes and encoding. Frankly, a lot of really interesting stuff is happening on HF frequencies, because traditionally people, particularly in the amateur radio world, have thought of those, you know, frequencies down below 30 megahertz that allow
international direct communications, but where we typically are constrained in Alabama and so forth, is being only suitable for things like the CWN and the sideband voice and these really narrow data rate things and communication streams and so forth. But it turns out if you're willing to apply interesting thoughts and ideas about high code signals, you can actually get interesting other applications going even over those frequencies. And having robust message transfer over HF at low power to a ship 60 or to people that are not on walkabout somewhere or something, it's an interesting idea that lots of people are interested in. And of course, a lot of folks playing with these are literally just playing with them. They're intrigued by the technology and trying to learn more about it, and a lot of them don't have a specific goal. A lot of them discover something that's really cool, and they start sort of obsessing on that for a while. To me, it's the EME thing. I could easily just use that radio I showed you and do all my EME stuff with that radio, but where does it come to your matter? It's a hobby, and to some extent, the goal of a hobby is to make it as hard as possible so that at the end you get the greatest sense of reward. seriously, the first time I built the Agile mount for the dish, I oops in one of the important pieces was a little too flexible, and so I couldn't get the dish to steady down when I was swimming. And so, I got frustrated and irritated and went off and did another 10 business trips around the world, came back and 6 weeks, 8 weeks later and sat down and rebuilt that piece. And then, the last time I went out to operate, I discovered that oops, I left the power on for the incremental encoders on the absolute code encoders on the two axes, and while I was out of town for a 3-day domestic trip, my finished one to come by and zap the RX-485 transceivers and encoders. So before I could actually figure out which way the dish was pointed to convince the system that it was okay to move the dish, I had to disassemble the encoders and replace the whole surface mount transceiver, which is not much fun. So, it's one of those things that at the end of the day, for me, it's just all about bringing lots of hobby interests together and having the project and all projects that you want to talk about and fun to do. And I'm not too worried about whether it's really, for me, it doesn't matter if it's really practical. If I get a chance to help other people go, oh, wow, I could do something really interesting with that, which has happened a couple times in the last few years, and that's cool. Other questions? Okay, well, I realize you've been sitting here for a long time. There's still 10 minutes or so before the bottom of the hour, and I guess in the lunch break or something. What I'd like to suggest is those of you that have sort of had enough, feel free to get up and walk out at any time. Those of you that are interested, I guess we'll try and pull a couple more things to go. See, did you have one of the, did you have any screenshots or something? Actually, I'll invite Phil here for a second to show you what some of these other things that people learn in the camera area will look like. Do you want to just show you?
Yes.
So actually, it's interesting. There are some cute little DVD receivers with USB interfaces now. And again, the interesting question is, what is it you're really trying to accomplish? Because if all you really want to do is receive these signals, you can spend a certain amount of time playing around doing. Dude, that's cool. I thought, wasn't your old laptop on this once you had to do this?
No,
that was your older one. It's the one you gave to your boss. Yeah. You want this one? Yeah. Can you see how to take this off, though? I can't figure out which way to flip.
Yeah, there you go. So I thought I would take the opportunity to really poke fun at my colleague. This is actually BDAL's first ham radio station. No, I'm just kidding. So just real quick, I said one of the things BDAL was talking about earlier was using sound cards being built in laptops to do more basic digital radio and software-defined radio sort of things, rather than try and do a live demonstration, which will take a bit of fiddling. I just wanted to show a couple of screenshots of some operating I did right before Linux Conf in Dunedin last year. So basically what I had, this is in a little lodge my wife, daughter, and I went to visit. This is Rachel and I putting up an antenna, a couple of shots like this. And this is basically the setup I was using on the day. So this is just my regular ThinkPad. The radio on the right there has about 20 watts, was running about 20 watts output power. It's kind of a bigger brother of the one that VDL and held up earlier. But basically the way PSK31 works is that the text in red on the screen there is what I was typing to the other operator. The text in black is what the other operator is sending back to me. This is all really, really low baud rate. It's of the order of 30 baud. So like 30, sorry?
31.
Indeed, 31 characters per second. It's called PSK. Thank you for that. There we go. There's no error correction, as you can see, and you'll see if you take the time to read through the text, there's sort of various terms and so forth. We're using 73, for example, as best wishes, is sort of like a set of lingo that predates even SMS, I suppose, for that. So basically what was happening here is I was using that very portable setup that you saw there being set up. I was in New Zealand talking to a fellow up in New Caledonia, which is, I think I worked out like four or five hundred kilometres with a very, very modest setup. The way PSK31 works and why it's become such a popular mode is, it's a little hard to see on this screen here, but this is basically a typical voice channel of about 2.5 kilohertz across the screen here. The idea is as you're operating, you move this blue cursor across the band. It's kind of like a waterfall display. So when you have signals coming in, you see a stream, like a line running down the page with the individual transmissions. The upshot of this ends up being you can get 10, 20 or more simultaneous conversations, albeit quite low bandwidth, in a single voice channel, and it's particularly effective even in quite weak signal conditions where you've got a lot of noise on a channel, and that's sort of a mixture of a particularly efficient encoding scheme that's being used, but also the fact that at the end of the day it's a human being interpreting what's being said. So they've got a reasonable idea of how the conversation is going to run. But in terms of the hardware setup for this, it was basically just a regular laptop using the sound card inbuilt with the little interface box that we held up earlier that just has a couple of transformers in it to do electrical isolation between the sound card input and output and the rig. Not much else to note on that one. This is all free software. This is GMFSK, which is one of the two more popular standalone digital communication packages for Linux, and it sort of, I guess, borrows a lot of the models of GNU Radio, but is actually a separate project. So that was just the three I had set up. Depending on whether people want to get up and go out, there's one other that had the sound mode and stuff that we could run through real quick. But any questions on this before we move on? Okay. Yeah, I might be able to do that. I haven't run the... That's actually just a static screenshot. All right, we should go into the truly uncharted thing. Now, more of a sort of funny one, because it's actually relatively harder to decode, because although there's a notionally irregular timing to it, I should have thought to do this earlier. Morse is a bit harder, but it was never really designed for automatic reception, so there's no obvious start bits, stop bits. So this is the waterfall display I was mentioning earlier. So feed up and keep that up for another moment. So that's actually just picking up, I guess, the sound in the room there, but and VDL so kindly whistled just a moment ago. So the intensity of the colour indicates the amplitude. So the stronger the signal, the brighter the colour there. And you can see we basically just drag this cursor backwards and forwards. So I will make sure that's going to make much difference. So there's a bunch of different operating modes available to you there, which you can see. PSK31 is by far the most common. Yeah, it has actually got CW. Is it? Okay, there you go. We could probably no, I thought that might transmit to this. Why am I getting no sound? Yeah. No, I could just check the volume set, I suppose. If I was using a HP laptop, this is much better. No, I really do apologize. I don't know why that's not actually making a sound for us. It's probably because it's the demo.
It is kind of interesting because the PSK-31 signals end up looking like a pair of adjacent lines. We call them railroad tracks. And as they're coming down the screen, you can literally just sort of grab the mouse and go over and click on one, and you start to see that one be decoded. And if it's an interesting contact, if it's somebody you'd like to chat with, you wait until they're done with their current conversation, then you can type something at them and transmit back on the same little frequency they were sitting on, and they get to see it. And if they hear you, you start communicating. And it's just an amazing hoot to sit in some out-of-the-way place with a little whip antenna, or as Hugh had, one of these little buddy pole dipole things, or as I had on the beach, it was, or a 20-meter dipole. That was, about 30 feet of wire thumbtacked to the railing, wooden railing of the deck on the back of the beach house. And you're sitting there with a few watts and having a conversation with somebody that's 12,000 miles away. Oh, sound server's not running? Oh, ESD not found. Dude. So anyway, there's just, from a package standpoint, I don't know about other distributions, but in the Debian distribution and therefore in Debian derivatives like Ubuntu, there's a separate ham radio section for historical reasons that is populated with all sorts of interesting stuff like this. So if you choose to get a ham radio license and want to join us on the bands and play around with this stuff, you really can just sort of apt-get install interesting apps like this, playing around with it, spend the rest of the afternoon figuring out why your sound doesn't work. Yeah, any case. Any other questions for us? We're pretty much at the end of our time, but if you've got one, feel free. Go ahead. Oh, right, yeah, it's Bulgaria, I think. It's really very simple. In fact, what I got from the guy who did that, David Carr, is just the bare circuit board. And then it turns out, at least in the U.S., the Linear Technologies A to D converter and the little Texas Instruments instrumentation amplifier part that he's using are both available as free samples over the web if you, tell him you're a consultant or something, which I gleefully do. And actually, it's interesting because, when you go to request free samples from semiconductor manufacturers, they have all these things where, you're supposed to tell them, is this something you're thinking about maybe doing someday, or are you going into production next month? And you always pick the one that's at the least end of relevance. And then they have the, what's your parts requirement going to be? And I always pick the zero to something one at the bottom end of the range, not the I need a million of them next month. And so I figure I've done everything I could possibly do to, disqualify myself. And if they still send me the parts, then Turok will build things, we'll talk about them in public, and maybe other people will go get free samples from them. Thanks, everyone.